Radio is mainly an opinion paranormal talk show. All opinions, comments, or statement of fact expressed by PIR Radio's guests are strictly their own and do not represent or to be endorsed by PIR Radio, ASPRN, Paranormal Radio Network, and their affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, this is Brian Fitzgerald from Ghost Hunters International, and you're listening to Pirate Investigators Radio.
Welcome to PIR Radio. PIR Radio is sponsored by the Peach State Paranormal Society and www.hauntedtube.com. Let's now go get your paranormal radio experience with your hosts, Kurt Smith and Bill Horton.
Alrighty, it's Monday, and you know it's PIR Radio time. We're excited. We have a great show lined up. But before we get to the show, as always, we have to do our little our housework, our cleaning, you know. So if you get a chance, don't forget to visit our website out. It's www.pirradio.com. We'd love you to check out the website. We have the Facebook fan page on there too. So if you like that, you can take a look at that. Check us out there too. You know, like it. Get updated information about the show. Upcoming guest and a contest, and Bill will be talking about a contest that we'll have later on during the show. So, as always, I have my co-host with me, Bill, with me.
Hey, Kurt, how's it going?
Good, going good, doing real good. How's it going with Bill? And it's always sunny in Philadelphia.
Well, it was sunny today and warm, and I really enjoyed it. And hey, you know, as case manager of Tri-County Paranormal, we got another email case, and I did email them right away. And I also asked them when a good time to call us, so now I got to call them. I got to keep on these cases. I got a pile that have gone unreturned answer to me, so I don't know what to do. But outside of that, yes, we have a very exciting giveaway tonight for all those listening fans that are in the chat room live. At the end of the show, we're going to take a caller and give away a DVD compilation of the first 2 years and the first 100 episodes of PIR Radio. And as I understand it, Kurt's going to make it available, and I think we're going to sell it on the website for like $5 or $6 just to cover cost and work towards that remote trip to somewhere. Maybe in inspiration of our guest, maybe we'll go to England or something, huh?
Yeah, that'd be cool, definitely. I would love to go over there.
But outside of that, you know, the paranormal thing's been kind of quiet. Maybe it's the transition from dark, cold winter to springtime, and people are, you know, when they're home alone, they hear things. And
well, the spring solstice or something. Maybe it's bringing in the paranormal activity now. Maybe it died down for a little bit. Maybe they were on vacation or something down south. Now that the spring solstice is coming, it's going to get better.
True.
And yes, everyone out there, I apologize. I forgot to change the encoder back from last week from live 2 to live, so hopefully everyone can hear the show now. So I apologize. We had a minor little technical difficulty, but it's should be hopefully everyone can hear. Give it a second. If you have to refresh. But, you know, that's what happens sometimes with technical stuff. But we have a great show lined up. We have an awesome guest lined up, and I'm excited that he accepted our invitation on the PIR Radio. So, let's not waste any more time, Bill. What do you say?
Yeah, let's bring him on.
All right. We have our guest tonight is Nicholas Redfern, and we're going to be talking about one of his newest books, the NASA Conspiracies. You with us, Nick?
Yeah, hey guys, how's it going?
Doing great. We're real excited that you accepted our invitation to come on and talk about NASA conspiracies, and maybe we'll get into some other. You know, I know you do. You've done Bigfoot, and I know I heard you on a show talk about Chupacabra. Maybe we can brush into that, but I think the main topics would be the UFO, aliens, and the NASA conspiracies.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about, that's fine with me. I've done a lot of stuff, so you can do whatever you want to do. So.
Right. Well, before we start, we always give the chance for our guests to give out their website and any way folks can contact you, and we'll also let you do it at the end of the show. That way, people can check out your website. So, if you want to give out your websites and how people can contact you, that'd be awesome.
All right. Well, I have a website, which is nickredfern.com, and people can email me direct from there. And I also do a lot of different blogs on everything from Bigfoot to other strange creatures, UFOs, Hollywood scandal, all sorts of things. And people can find the blogs at the main website. They're all linked there. And I try and update a lot of those at least a couple of times a week.
Awesome. Now with your book, the NASA Conspiracies, give us a little background of why you wanted to write a book about these conspiracies.
Well, basically, the book itself is a study, as the title suggests, of course, a study of NASA conspiracy theories leveled at NASA. And a lot of these, of course, relate to UFOs, but not all of them. Some of them are also more down-to-earth conspiracies, but, you know, by the same token, weird as well. And a lot of books have been written over the years on the Face on Mars controversy and the moon landings, you know, did we or didn't we really go? And although I cover them in the book, you know, for the most part, as I said, a lot of books have been written on those areas relative to NASA, but not to a lot of other significant mysteries concerning the space agency. And I thought, well, you know, I've got a lot of data, a lot of witness testimony that's never really been seen before, that, you know, as it relates to NASA and things like UFOs, alien abductions, contact cases, all sorts of things. And I thought, well, you know, because this is all brand new and it's not just sort of going over old ground, why not put this out for people to see who are interested in, you know, these stories about NASA, and, you know, give people something new to see as it relates to, you know, the involvement of the space agency and some sort of weird mysteries, if you like.
Now, I know in regards to NASA, I know they, you know, there's a lot of top secret material, and, you know, you have witnesses that really won't talk. Did you find it difficult to gather the information for the book, talking to people, or actually getting to see information?
Well, you know, I guess it's kind of like when you're doing any sort of investigative journalism, really. You know, it very rarely just comes to you on a plate. You know what I mean? It's like you've got to dig for the information, and you know, there's two things you can do. If you face hurdles, you can give up and lose, or you just keep digging. You know, it's one of these things where I treat, although, you know, I'm trained in journalism is my original background. I used to work on a rock music magazine back in England, and then did a lot of mainstream newspaper work. And, you know, I treat this subject like any mainstream journalistic story, that you follow leads and ideas and stories. And, you know, if you reach a hurdle, you phone people up and, you know, press for answers and ask if they can put you in touch with somebody else, and then they can put you in touch with somebody else. And finally, you know, you start to build a picture up that tells a story. And then hopefully, you know, when you've actually reached that point, you know, from there onwards, you know, you try and see if there's anything else and get corroborative data, and hopefully you do. So that's basically my approach. You know, you just have to keep pushing and pushing until the doors open to the extent that you can conceivably get them open.
Your investigative reporting, did you, you know, have any issues like with you know, our government, you know, and all this might kind of sound weird or psycho, but, you know, were they, you know, like they would be following you, or, you know, you're not digging too deep?
Not really. No, I mean, not really. I mean, two of the things I've always tried to do is, one is, you know, is to use the Freedom of Information Act to get documents. So, in other words, you know, the documents I reproduce in the book are all, you know, there's nothing like WikiLeaks or anything like that. You know, I don't go down that path. You know, everything in the book, all the documents that are reproduced in there, are actually declassified officially through the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. And I think this adds to the credibility of these accounts, you know, when you can actually look at verifiable government documents that the government have personally allowed, you know, have put into the public domain. You know, I think that adds credibility to a story. And what I've also done is quoted the on-the-record testimony of people like astronauts, you know, and people attached to the space agency. So, in other words, you know, I'm not sort of, you know, doing things like from an illegal perspective. You know, as I said, all the documents are officially sanctioned release documents, and, you know, the people I've interviewed are space agency employees or retirees. You know, and I think that does add credibility, because as interesting as whistleblower testimony can be, you know, it always has more of a grounding when you've actually got people whose backgrounds can be verified and, you know, are speaking openly, shall we say.
So, Nick, I wanted to know, maybe you could touch base on a couple of the most compelling stories or the most interesting stories that you that intrigued you the most, or you got the wow factor and said, wow, this makes total sense, you know, like, it's all here, it's in black and white, and, mm-hmm. and maybe if you want to tell about some of them, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the ones that I find is sort of a really impressive case is an incident that occurred in Bolivia in May 1978, and this is sort of relative to the whole issue of crashed UFOs. Now, when everybody talks about crashed UFOs and dead aliens, you know, everybody's first tendency is to think about Roswell, you know, the famous Roswell incident of July 1947 when, you know, reportedly some sort of weird objects and some equally weird bodies were found in the New Mexico desert after some sort of accident or crash. And, of course, you know, the government's actually changed its story on the event three times with regard to what actually happened or didn't happen. But the Roswell story doesn't stand alone, and this incident from Bolivia in 78 actually deeply implicates NASA. What happened is that some sort of object impacted on a mountainside not too far from the Bolivian capital in May 1978, and the American embassy in Bolivia got wind of the story, and started making inquiries. They in turn contacted the State Department, who also contacted NASA. And there was this sort of back and forth of telegrams saying, you know, have we launched a satellite or a rocket that's crashed? You know, even a classified spy satellite or something like that. Nobody in NASA knew anything about it. Clearly NASA hadn't launched anything. So then attention was turned to the Russians. You know, they launched a space satellite or some sort of probe that had crashed and they weren't saying anything. So all orbital trackings, etc., Russian craft were tracked and examined, and they hadn't lost anything either. So then it became even more intriguing that something had come down from space and slammed into this mountain. Now, you know, at first glance, you might say, well, maybe it was a meteorite. But when you look at the reports that were coming out of the Bolivian military, there was talk about the Bolivian military cordoning off the site and finding some sort of 15-foot diameter / egg-shaped object, which is clearly manufactured. Now, the important thing about this case is that we have a few fragmentary documents that have surfaced through the terms of the Freedom of Information Act, which demonstrate that NASA was being kept informed at every given moment with respect to these particular incidents, or this incident, I should say, and what was going on and how the military was supposedly retrieving this object. And again, this is an important factor because, you know, these are official files and we can verify NASA was deeply interested in knowing the nature of this object. And there are references in the files to NASA personnel being invited down by the Bolivian government to examine whatever the object was. And intriguingly, that's when the files suddenly come to a grinding halt, is when we find out that the object's been recovered and then brought back for examination. And then suddenly, literally, all the information goes underground. But, you know, for me, this is a significant story because we have verification from the Bolivian military. We've got the State Department and the American Embassy in Bolivia sending telegrams and information to both NASA and also to the CIA. And we know that a contingent of military and NASA personnel from the U.S. went down to Bolivia to examine this object. Now, what it was, that still remains an open question. But, you know, I think this is an important one because we've actually got some insight into a crash case like this, which we very rarely get anything along the lines of official documents, etc.
So do you think the Bolivia government just was not, like, Roswell was what, in 54? What was Roswell?
47.
And,
yeah.
You know, I actually saw a show on History Channel last night, which was kind of timely for this. But they said that, you know, the guy was like, hey, you know, in 47, Roswell and this and that, we kind of were sloppy and there was a couple others, but the U.S. government over the years had just gotten better at cleaning these things up. So now back to 78, and do you think the Bolivian government just didn't care enough or know enough, like, you know, like in 47 from Roswell for the U.S. government?
Yeah, I actually think that's what it was. I think, you know, I think there are certain governments around the world that have been briefed on what's known about UFOs at a very top secret level. But equally, I think there are a lot of countries that probably don't know much more than the average UFO researcher because they've not sort of been brought into the inner circle, if you like. And I think what this means is that occasionally a significant UFO event might occur in a country that hasn't been briefed on what's really going on. And so when they have a UFO incident, a significant one, you know, they're as much in the dark, ironically, as we are, you know. And I think that's why they probably ask for help and guidance in, you know, what is this, how do we deal with it? And that's when, you know, NASA and the intelligence people came in and offered help. Now, what actually happened to the object, you know, whether it remained in Bolivia, whether it brought to the U.S. or who knows what, you know, we're sort of grasping at straws when it comes to that. But certainly there does seem to be strong evidence that there was some sort of Bolivian-American liaison on the examination of the object. There's actually even references to where it seems like the Bolivian military were actually at some point reluctant to share data and may have even been given cover stories to the U.S., you know, that it's been recovered or, no, we didn't really find anything after all. So maybe there were people in the government that didn't want to share it, you know, outside of Bolivia, which, you know, might be understandable if they thought they got their hands on something really special. But then again, there are other pointers that suggest maybe eventually they did come around to the idea of, well, much of this technology is beyond us. Let's share it and see what we can find out.
Now, I know Bill brought up the Bolivia, but it seems like, you know, with Brazil, it seems like their government is releasing, has released all their UFO files. Do you think South America is a hotbed for UFO activity?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of sort of tremendous, really significant UFO reports over the years from South America of landing cases, crashes, close encounters, abductions, contact cases, all sorts of things. And why that should be the case, I don't know. But, I mean, it's kind of ironic that, you know, a lot of people, you think of UFO sightings, you always think of, like, America and Europe. But, ironically, South America, where we probably hear less from, but they've actually had probably far more UFO reports and very good UFO reports than a lot of other countries have. You know, people speculate, is it possible that they could, whatever these alien entities are, you know, they could have underground or undersea installations off the coast of South America. You know, there have been a lot of reports of people seeing UFOs coming out of the water, out of the oceans in South America, which has sort of inevitably led to theories that, well, you know, could they in theory have some sort of underground installation? So, you know, I think it's intriguing that we're getting a lot of reports from South America and then we hear stories of something crashing. You know, it's like if there's that many reports, it wouldn't perhaps be that out of the ordinary that something might crash if, you know, there's so many of these things flying around.
Now talking about, you know, I know we're talking about UFOs, and I actually love this topic, but, you know, with NASA, I know I'm reading your book, you know, and I went on your website, too, and I jotted down a couple of questions, and Bill mentioned, you know, have you talked to anyone that's interesting and what I jot down is that you got some interesting information from astronauts Edgar Mitchell and Gordon Cooper?
Yeah, I mean, Edgar Mitchell is probably one of the most important people in relation to the whole story of NASA and UFOs. Edgar Mitchell actually piloted one of the Apollo moon landings, and, you know, that in itself, you know, is pretty significant. And basically, I mean, his background, for people who aren't aware of the situation, he commanded the Apollo 14 lunar module that landed on the moon on February 5th, 1971. So as well as being, you know, one of the most well-known and renowned of the Apollo astronauts, he's also a firm believer in the whole issue of UFOs and alien encounters. But more importantly, and this relates to the Roswell story, Mitchell actually grew up around the Roswell area, and because of his prestige as an astronaut, you know, people, old-timers, would approach him and say, you know, hey, the Roswell incident really did occur and it did involve aliens. You know, they felt he was someone who it'd be okay to speak to and who would listen to them, you know, with an open and a serious mind, which he did. And when Mitchell began to hear more and more of these stories from respected old-timers in the area, what he actually did, he took his story to the Pentagon about what he'd been told, and he literally asked for a meeting with the Intelligence Committee of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, you know, if me or you had asked for that, they'd just sort of kick us out the building, you know. But with Mitchell, because of his background, he actually got a meeting with an admiral from the Pentagon who confirmed the reality of the Roswell story to him. Now, as I said, this isn't just some whistleblower talking. You know, this is Edgar Mitchell, who walked on the surface of the moon, saying he got inside confirmation from inside the Pentagon about Roswell. What was weird is that Mitchell actually went on a couple of TV shows, like Larry King's show, for example, and various radio shows. And the weird thing is that the mainstream media just did not follow up on this at all. In fact, NASA actually said that, while, in their own words, while Dr. Mitchell is a great American, we don't share his opinions on this issue. But the irony is that Mitchell actually wasn't giving an opinion. He was actually saying that he'd been briefed on what happened at Roswell by insider sources at the Pentagon. So it was almost like his words were being twisted around to make it sound like he was giving an opinion on UFOs rather than relating a meeting that he had with somebody in the Pentagon. You know, and you have to wonder sometimes when the media just doesn't touch these stories. You know, what could be bigger than a NASA astronaut saying he'd been briefed on the fact that aliens had crashed at Roswell? You know, but the media didn't touch it. You know, to me, this is a bizarre thing. They should have been on this story, you know, like a cracked team of journalists trying to solve it, but they just let it drop, which is, you know, you can either look at it that it's unfortunate, or is there a conspiracy, even in the media, not to talk about this?
I agree with that, Nick. I agree that's the perfect answer. There is a conspiracy with the media. I strongly believe that the government can control and withhold information and can filter the truth. And that's just my belief because, you know, I was in the military, but not that I knew anything because I was only an E-4, but, you know, it's their objective is to convince people of what they want, you know, the belief to be.
Yeah.
And they do that.
Yeah, but, and I think, you know, I mean, you know yourself, I'm quite sure that, you know, that the vast majority of people in government don't know anything about this subject at all. You know, I think, you know yourself, being in the military, when you join the military, you're clear to know what you need to know to do your job. That's how secrets are kept, you know. That's how defense of the relevant country is maintained. You know, not everybody's briefed on everything because, in a worst-case scenario, not, you know, something goes wrong, it doesn't fall into the wrong hands, hopefully. But I think with the whole UFO issue, I think the number of people who are really in the know is probably so small, so elite, and so select that that's why it's difficult to resolve what's going on because, you know, your average employee of the FBI or the CIA or the NSA or Army Intelligence or whoever, you're not briefed because you have no need to know. And so, in other words, you know, it's often a tendency to think if you join the CIA or whoever, you know, they automatically tell you what happened at Roswell, but that would be absurd. You know, if you're not cleared to know or have any need to know, then you're not going to find out any more than we are, really, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that you know, it's a simple fact of the matter, you know. I mean, and you know, conspiracy, that word always seems to trigger, like, oh, there's something, you know, secretive or...
Yeah.
And it's all government, you know, this or that. But, you know, and I think it might be just as simple as that, you know. It just... Too much information in the wrong hands would create, and like you said, you're not going to join the FBI or the Pentagon in any sort and automatically have access to this data. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah. And I actually do believe, where I disagree with a lot of people with the UFO subject, you know, I actually have some sympathies with the people who hide in the secret. You know, I don't agree that it should be withheld, but if they are in possession of some sort of really dark secret, which I don't rule out, you know, I can understand why it might be a struggle to say, well, can the public handle this? Should we tell them or not? And it might be easier from their perspective to say, let's just hide it all. It's just far easier to do that. Now, while I understand and kind of sympathize with that, I still think no one has the right to keep just to a select group the evidence that, you know, we're not alone in the universe. Even if it's not all good news, I think it's our right as a species to know that we're not alone. So.
Well, did you read, talking about that, there's been articles on the Internet that some scientists found alien life form on meteorites?
Yeah, this is something that's sort of been an ongoing controversy for a while. You know, the idea that if we one day find alien life, everybody thinks, you know, it's going to come through little green men in nuts and bolts spacecraft. But there's been a lot of debate, and particularly more just recently, about, you know, the idea of meteorites coming to Earth, which could have remains of like alien microbes on them. Now, on the one hand, that's fascinating, and, you know, it's a great challenge to us if we find alien life that's even microbial, you know, rather than, you know, bodies or craft, etc. It's life is still life at the end of the day. One of the areas that hasn't been touched upon that much, but which is of deep concern to NASA, is the idea that if some sort of alien life came to the Earth, what if it wasn't just a microbe or, you know, a rudimentary form of life? What if it was some sort of alien virus, you know, within a microbe or a cell? This is actually a scenario played out in Michael Crichton's novel, The Andromeda Strain, where a lethal alien virus is brought back to Earth and almost sort of wipes out the human race, or has the ability to. You know, that's a very real worry on the part of NASA, the idea that, you know, if a virus of extraterrestrial origins was brought back to the Earth inadvertently, you know, in a test tube or, you know, or something was brought back from Mars, shall we say, a rock, and it had a virus attached to it, like in a microbe, it's entirely possible our defense systems, our immune systems, might not be able to cope with it. It would be like literally a doomsday virus for us because, you know, that our bodies have no way to combat it. And that's sort of a very worrying thing about if microbial life actually is brought to Earth on a meteorite or however.
Do you think NASA or any government has any evidence that there could be possible alien viruses?
Well, I mean, there are rumors about that. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that when the Apollo astronauts first came back from the moon, they actually had to go through like a decontamination program. And this was specifically due to these worries and fears. Now, the moon itself, of course, you know, doesn't have an atmosphere. You know, it's a complete vacuum. And viruses would be very difficult for them to survive. But Mars, which does have an atmosphere, and there's also evidence of frozen water at its polar caps, you know, that's a very different story. So, you know, if we ever send manned missions to Mars, then it's not impossible that, you know, massive plans would have to be put in place to decontaminate the astronauts when they got back. Now, that's all theoretical. But there are stories and rumors about outbreaks of weird viruses across the world that it's been suggested, you know, that they might be have extraterrestrial origins. That's actually been put forward for the SARS virus when that broke out a few years ago. Just out of nowhere, people were saying, well, you know, could it have been something that, you know, literally reached the Earth rather than originated on the Earth?
Hey, Nick, if you can hold on, we're going to take a real quick break for our ghost story with Lex Wall. So if you can hang on, we'll be right back with you.
Yeah, sure.
Alrighty, folks, you're listening to PIR Radio Night on the PRO Radio Network. It's kind of tongue-tied tonight. But don't forget, all your podcast listeners out there, come check us out live, because if you do, each week we might be giving away a copy of the first 100 episodes of PIR Radio, or the first 2 years. So check us out live in the chat room at www.pirradio.com and click the Pro tab, or go to www.paranormalradioonline.com. And folks, don't forget, our guest tonight is Nick Redfern. Go ahead and check out his website. It's www.nickredfern.com. And enjoy this story from Lex Wall, and we'll be right back.
PIR Radio will be right back after these messages.
This is Lex Wall of the Evening Ghost Show, and this story was sent in by Cynthia in Texas. My ex-husband lived in a house that, according to his mother, had paranormal activity in it. She was told that when she was a young girl in Mexico, that she is open to spirits and that they are attracted to her. Consequently, everywhere she's lived, there was some sort of activity. I never saw anything in the house. My experiences were always feeling footsteps in the house. First, my ex and I were in his brother's room, going through his music selection. My ex got up to leave the room to get something from the kitchen. At this time, I was not aware of anything they felt or saw in the house. I had my back to the bedroom door, sitting on the floor. I felt footsteps, like my ex was walking back into the room. But it felt like tiptoeing, because the walking was slow and light. thinking it was my ex sneaking up on me. I spoke out loud, "Don't even try it," when the walking stopped. I turned around, and of course no one was there. My ex walked back into the room and asked who I was talking to. I was speechless. That's when he told me about the strange things that always happened in that house. And it was not surprising to him to hear my tale. Another time, we were sitting outside on the front porch, again on the floor, and I got the feeling of footsteps in the living room, like people were running back and forth from the living room to the bedrooms. Every time I would turn around expecting someone to be there right behind me, and every time, no one was there. The family would experience shadows, reflections in the mirrors, shaking doors and beds, blankets being pulled off sleeping people. Scary stuff to me, but they took it in stride. When eventually they moved to another house, my daughter would spend the night. And when she was about 4 or 5, she would come home and tell me about a young girl who would watch her sleep. She described the girl as being about 10 years old, skinny, with long brown hair in 2 braids. There was a great deal of detail to her description, but now, when asked about it, she doesn't remember any of it. And that's it for this week's story, and now back to Kurt and Bill.
Haunted Voices Radio Network welcomes our newest affiliate, Pro Paranormal Radio Online, helping to bring you the best paranormal experience. Check out Pro today by going to ParanormalRadioOnline.com for showtimes and a chat area to chat with other paranormal listeners. While there, check out the Encore shows where you can listen to many different shows and hosts and their podcasts that you may have missed during the week. Check out live shows and special broadcast shows that are live on location with special events. All of this and so much more can be found on ParanormalRadioOnline.com. It's about the paranormal, and it's all here for you. Once again, Haunted Voices Radio Network welcomes our newest affiliate, Pro ParanormalRadioOnline.com. Check. As always, thanks for listening to the Haunted Voices Radio Network.
And now, back to your regularly scheduled program on BIR Radio.
We are back with our guest tonight, Nicholas Redfern, and we're talking NASA conspiracies, UFOs, and now, everyone's still with us, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yep, so the men in black have not got us. I do have a chat room question. This comes from Chicken Zombie Tom. He's a avid listener of PIR Radio, and he wants to know, Nick, have you ever encountered any men in black?
I personally haven't, but I've actually got a new book coming out in June all about the history of the men in black, and it's called The Real Men in Black, and it deals with a whole range of new witnesses, new reports, going back to the early days of UFOs, right up to the present day, and a lot of new theories and data suggesting who the men in black might be, and so I'll make sure you get a copy of that book when it comes out. And that should be out in about 3 months, something like that. But I've never personally had that sort of slow knock on the front door, and, you know, the guys in the black suits and sunglasses. But who knows? The closer you get to the truth, who knows? So.
Have you ever had anybody with all your government contacts that you might have been able to look you up and see if you're on the FBI watch list?
No, I haven't. But, I mean, you know, joking aside, I mean, what I try and do is, you know, most of my stuff is just relative to UFOs, you know, and as I said, for the most part, you know, I use, like, the Freedom of Information Act, which is all, you know, perfectly legal stuff. I'm not like, you know, some WikiLeaks guy and hacking into computers and stuff like that, you know. I would never go down that path. It's just not worth the risk, you know. And also because, you know, there's good, solid legal ways of getting the information. A lot of people don't realize that. It's just a matter of being persistent. And also, you know, I like to quote the people like the testimony of people like Edgar Mitchell, because, you know, these are astronauts, Apollo people, military people talking on the record, You know, so in that respect, we can make a very strong case without having to go down a path that, you know, gets you into deep, you know what, with the official world or whatever.
Now, you said, you know, with WikiLeaks and all that. Now I have a question in regards to Gary McKinnon's attempt to hack into NASA computers for evidence of UFO and alien life. Was he ever successful, or did he get caught?
Yeah, well, Gary McKinnon is this English guy who developed an interest in UFOs, and in 2001 decided to go looking for UFO data in a way that I definitely don't recommend anybody ever does this. What he did, he thought, well, you know, if the government's not going to tell the truth, that means I've got to then go looking for the answers. And instead of, you know, tracking down people and getting on the record interviews or, you know, filing freedom of information requests, he literally hacked into NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, where about 10 years ago, a woman named Donna Hare, who worked for a NASA contractor company called Philco, she was essentially like a whistleblower, but she went on the record. She said that when she was working in the Johnson Space Center, a colleague of hers told her how one of his specific jobs was to airbrush photographs, NASA photographs, before they were released to the public. And when they showed anomalies like flying saucers, it was his job to airbrush them out, and then they would release the pictures to the public. And Gary McKinnon heard Donna Hare's testimony and thought, well, if she's saying that this is where it was going on in this particular building, that's where I'm going to hack into. And that's precisely what he did. And in the 10 years that have gone by since he did this, attempts have been made by the U.S. government to bring him to America to stand trial. Because, you know, he literally did illegally hack into their computers. And if you're going to do that, you know, if any government's computer systems, you know, the idea that they're not going to know or find out is stupid. You know, of course they will. And so that's why there's this sort of ongoing to-ing and fro-ing between the British and the American government to have him brought over to the U.S. to stand trial, whereas his legal team says, well, even if he goes to trial, he should stand trial in England because his crime was committed in England, even though he targeted a U.S. computer system. So, in other words, it's a bit of a grey area as to where exactly the law was broken. Was it broken via his computer terminal in England, or was it broken in the U.S.? But in terms of what he saw, this is where it kind of gets interesting. By his own admission, he didn't download anything, so we only have his word for what he saw. But he said he saw photographs that seemed to show strange artificial objects in space. And he said he also saw documents that referred to something known as non-terrestrial officers. And McKinnon interpreted this, and he might be right, he interpreted this as meaning like some sort of secret space program beyond the officially known one. You know, non-terrestrial to McKinnon sounded obviously like something off the planet. And officers, it almost sounded like a fleet list of personnel. And he kind of likened it, you know, to the idea of some sort of, you know, off-planet secret space program, you know, like the equivalent of the crew of an aircraft carrier on the oceans. But it was like a listing of personnel working on some secret space program. And so that the irony is that, you know, if the prosecution of McKinnon had been wrapped up 7-8 years ago, nobody would know about his story and his revelations. But the fact that it's been going on so long and it's turned into such a soap opera now, you know, everybody and his brother knows the story, and any attempts to sort of keep it locked down have sort of failed by virtue of the fact that it's had so much publicity that it probably wouldn't have had if he'd been offered, you know, a year sentence or suspended sentence for 18 months. But that didn't happen. You know, it was like it just became like a huge media thing where even went to the office of the British Prime Minister and, you know, higher levels of the U.S. government. So.
Interesting. Now, going on with her interview, I know it during the break we were going to talk about the and I'm really interested to hear your take on the face on Mars.
Yeah, sure. Well, the face on Mars, I'm sure most of your listeners may have heard of it, but you know, not everybody's sort of fully aware of the intricacies of it. Basically, the face on Mars is this huge looks like a carved face-like structure in an area of Mars known as Cydonia, which lies approximately 10 degrees north of the Martian equator. It was first photographed on July the 25th, 1976, by NASA's Viking 1 space probe. And it's literally like this huge face-like thing staring upwards from the planet. Now, NASA itself doesn't avoid talking about the face on Mars. They're quite happy to. But when they're asked, their specific response is, it's kind of like people seeing faces in clouds. You know, that's their viewpoint, that if you look close enough anywhere and shadows and things like that, you can see things, whatever you want to see. And that's their public view, at least. However, what I did for the book was to interview a lot of people who, in the research community, the Face on Mars research community, one being a man named Matt Tonis, who in 2004 wrote a book called After the Martian Apocalypse. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, after speaking to Mark about his book, which is a very balanced book on the phenomenon, there's no doubt in my mind that the face on Mars is a very ancient carved structure of some sort. Now, when I say ancient, you know, even within the Face on Mars research community, people are talking about anywhere from 100,000 to 250,000 or even 500,000 years ago. So in other words, whoever made it, they're long gone. You know, Mars today does have an atmosphere. There is evidence of extensive frozen water at both its north and south poles. There's even evidence on some photographs of what could possibly be small pockets of running water still. And a number of photographs that NASA have released seem to show also what looks like weird vegetation on the planet. So Mars may not be the dead planet that a lot of people assume it to be. But that doesn't mean, you know, that it's teeming with life. It may be just rudimentary. But if the face on Mars is a real carved structure, which I actually believe it is, then clearly at some point in its ancient past, if it had intelligent life forms that could build these massive constructions, then there must have been, you know, a society, not necessarily say exactly like ours, but they clearly had to have building tools, some sort of civilization and society, cities probably, things like that. And because the face points upwards rather than outwards, it clearly is meant to be seen from the sky, which would imply that whoever the builders were, they had, you know, at least aviation, you know, aircraft, if not spaceflight. Now, the assumption, and I think it's a correct assumption, is at some point in its ancient past, Mars must have suffered from some gigantic planet-wide disaster that destroyed its atmosphere and, you know, the planet, the life on the planet, and for all intents and purposes, the planet itself sort of spiraled down into destruction, at least in form of being, you know, supporting life or significant life. Now, what's interesting is that not too far away from the face, there are what look like very pyramid-like structures, very similar to the pyramids on Earth, but that also look damaged and sort of weather-beaten, as you would expect them to look after such amount of time. But because the face has this sort of Egyptian Sphinx look to it, and because you have these pyramid structures very close by, this has given rise to the theory that maybe some of these Martian entities, if their planet, you know, was faced with destruction, well, maybe they launched like a last-ditch attempt to at least save some of their race, left the planet and headed towards our planet. And maybe, you know, if things like Sphinx-like faces and pyramids were part of their culture, you know, that's the type of buildings and structures they made, is it possible they came here and influenced some of our early civilizations, like the Egyptians, the Mayans, etc., who had a fascination for pyramids? And, of course, you know, we have the famous Egyptian Sphinx. And a lot of these ancient cultures actually surfaced out of nowhere. There wasn't, like, a slow development on their part, which has given rise to the idea that, you know, if we were sort of helped by almost like a fleet of, you know, these last band of Martians who came here, then it would make sense if they were suddenly elevated technologically to quite an advanced level in a very short time. So in other words, the face doesn't necessarily just represent possibly something built by a very ancient race of Martians, but it's possible that it also is somehow linked with our ancient history, something that we've forgotten about. And I think if that is the case, you know, there could be all sorts of reasons for hiding the truth. You know, if a lot of our ancient stories, legends, etc., you know, can be found to be wrong, and we're actually the product of Martians almost, you know, that might be a reason for government agencies, you know, not wanting to bring too much attention to the face, shall we say.
Now, I got a question from a listener. He heard us talking about Gary McKinnon, but he has a question about Have you ever come across in your files from the government about a guy, a person named Bob Lazar, who claims to have performed reverse engineering work on alien ship for the U.S. government?
Yeah, I have. Bob Lazar was the guy who first surfaced in the late 1980s, and he had a very interesting story. He said he worked out at Area 51, Nevada, and when he was working, he said he was actually only working there, he said, for a brief time, but he was brought in, he had expertise in certain areas, and he said he was brought in to work on a number of what looked like highly advanced circular-shaped craft. Now, his first thought was that, well, the U.S. government has developed flying saucers, and they're the ones who have been flying them all along. The further he got into the project, he got these various briefings and historical documents to read to sort of get him up to speed on the project. And he was told that they were actually alien spacecraft that the government had acquired in some fashion. Some of them seemed damaged. Others didn't seem damaged at all. And, you know, wondered if they were even being donated or given to us by, you know, aliens, if you like. Now, his story is a very interesting one because, you know, he's stuck by it for more than 20 years, hasn't changed his story. And interestingly enough, he hasn't actually been, you know, prosecuted by the government for, you know, telling outrageous lies about the government. You know, in fact, there's been pretty much total silence where the government's almost been uneasy, you know, not even wanting to sort of open this sort of can of worms that Lazar has been talking about. And so in that respect, you know, he's an interesting guy. And we can also prove, literally prove, that he did spend some time doing contract work for the secret Los Alamos labs. That's an actual fact. So in other words, you know, he has a sort of background, and he's a bit of a maverick scientist as well. And I think on some of these projects where you're dealing with massively alternative technology, it's probably a good idea to bring in maverick scientists to a degree than it is mainstream scientists, because they're more likely to think outside of the box than someone, you know, for a regular scientist who's just stuck in their rigid ways. So I think it wouldn't surprise me because of, you know, as I said, Lazar was a bit of a maverick. It wouldn't surprise me if the government did bring in people precisely like him to get, like, a good, new, unique view on some of the, you know, some of the things that they were working on.
Hey, Nick, now I know that we were touching base on the fake, or not the fake, or the allegedly fake moon landings, and I wonder if you could lead us in that direction.
Yeah, sure. Well, the moon landings, I guess, you know, that's the biggest sort of conspiracy theory leveled at NASA, the idea that the moon landings didn't go ahead, as we're told, and they're actually sort of faked out at Area 51, maybe, you know, with all the desert rock and hills, etc., behind them. Now, with the book, it's called The NASA Conspiracies because, you know, I studied and looked at various NASA conspiracies, but I tried to do it from an open and balanced perspective, and in some cases I concluded there was a conspiracy to be resolved and answered, and in others, there wasn't. And I think, for me, the moon landings fall into the latter category, although, you know, a lot of people may disagree with me, and that's fair enough because we need debate on this issue. But personally speaking, I do think we went to the moon. And there's several reasons why I believe that. One, primarily, is the substantial amount of moon rock that the astronauts brought back with them. You know, it's actually very easy and demonstrable to show that moon rock is very different from any rock found on Earth. And one of the important things is that the moon rock samples have actually been analyzed outside of NASA. So, in other words, they've been independently studied. And there's no doubt that, you know, that they didn't come from the Earth. So, clearly, they were brought back from the moon. You know, and so it's things like this. But I will admit, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that whole swathes of the population do not believe we went. For example, in 1999, a Gallup poll was initiated all across the United States. And asked, you know, do you think we went to the moon in the fashion that NASA has told us? And the response that came back was that just over 18 million Americans flatly did not believe we went to the moon, you know, which is an astonishing number of people. And there is, you know, a huge culture, research culture and community that revolves around, you know, doing research in this area. And even though I think we did go, you know, I actually do encourage people to look at this whole argument, and I do think debate on this issue is essential because there are actually variations on the theory that we didn't go. One being that, yes, we went, but the, you know, there may have been close encounters with UFOs up there, and we haven't been told about those. Or that some of the photographs were staged. That's one of the alternative theories that's been put forward, is that, yes, the astronauts went, but the due to the sort of rigors of outer space radiation, the photographs were destroyed, so there was no actual proof they ever went. So they were forced to recreate the photographs for the benefit of the public, just to convince them. Now, of course, if that ever came out, no one would ever believe they went anyway. But in other words, there's not just the main theory that we didn't go. There are all these various spin-off theories that, yes, we went, but we saw UFOs, and so that had to be hidden, or, yes, we went, but the photographs had to be recreated. But what it all boils down to is that, you know, the story that we don't have the full picture of what happened on the moon landings. And that may well be the case. You know, there could have been things gone on the moon that we just didn't know about. We weren't told. But in literal terms, if we went or not, I think we did, yeah.
Well, you know, you have this launch, you have everybody see it, and where did these guys go? And then they splash down. I mean, nobody's in the ocean to see it outside of the sailors, but, yeah, they could have dropped them from a plane. But I believe that, you know, there was too much going on. And well, you know, I guess the last point would be that there was this race, you know, to do this, you know, and a lot of people forget that or don't know that, you know, because we wanted to be a dominating sort of power at that point, you know.
Yeah, you're right. And I think, you know, the race was obviously with the Russians. And I think the important thing is that we know now that with their spy satellites and spy planes and listening stations, we know that the Russians were monitoring the entire flights, the Apollo flights. And in my view, if there was any even a remote inkling on the part of the Russians that they knew that we didn't really go to the moon, that it was all a hoax, I think they would have said so publicly, because had they said so, and if the Russians could have proven it, it would have been so damaging to not just the entire space program, but to U.S. morale and everything else, that the space program probably would have collapsed. And I don't, because this was the height of the Cold War, if the Russians knew it was a hoax, and with all their listening abilities, I think they would have known if it was a hoax, they would have said so, because it would have been so much to their gain to do so. But the fact that they didn't, you know, say anything suggests to me that they knew that, yes, the flights were real.
Now, I have a question. I know our hour is coming up here shortly, so I just have a few more questions. One that gets me is the NASA and the Vatican. Do you think they're conspiring, or not conspiring, but in cahoots with one another to prepare us for a, you know, saying that there is actual alien life form out there?
Yeah, this is an interesting area, because in the recent years, the Vatican has been more and more vocal on the issue of alien life and how it's okay to believe in aliens and how it doesn't affect their teachings, etc. A lot of people don't realize the Vatican actually has its own observatory, and they've had a deep interest in astronomy for centuries. NASA works very closely with the Vatican on outer space issues, and they've held seminars together, you know, issues such as what would it mean for biblical teachings if aliens were found to be, you know, living outside of our solar system, etc. And a couple of years ago, the Vatican's in-house journal, their own in-house publication, actually published an article titled Aliens Are My Brother, which, you know, you can't really get much more to the point than that. And so because NASA is becoming more and more working in tandem with the Vatican, and the Vatican's becoming more and more open on the alien life angle, you know, this has inevitably led to theories that this is coming up towards some sort of announcement. You know, and even I have to admit personally, you know, it's a highly intriguing issue of why the Vatican is becoming more and more open and vocal on issues relative to outer space, astronomy, and UFOs. You know, maybe some sort of information or release is around the corner.
You never know. Hopefully.
Well, I just find it ironic that the Vatican would be so forthcoming and interested, but, you know, but I do have a question, and, you know, and I take this from my TV watch and the History Channel, but I know they had mentioned last night that a lot of the astronauts, in fact, did see things and did report things and did take pictures of strange objects out in space, and I don't know if you had any first-hand knowledge from all the astronauts that you had interviewed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is the Gemini flights of the 1960s. I mean, there's actually FBI documents have been officially declassified that talk about how NASA apparently had tracking devices on board one of the Gemini missions to track for UFOs. So, you know, we know that there's been attempts by astronauts in space to search for UFO activity. Gordon Cooper, one of the original Mercury astronauts, he had his own UFO encounter with what he described like a fleet of circular-shaped craft. And he was so convinced that when of UFO reality, Gordon Cooper, that when he retired as an astronaut, and in the 1970s and 1980s, when the United Nations was being lobbied to set up a UFO investigation program, he actually lent his weight and support to this project. And now it unfortunately didn't come to pass, but he actually prepared a statement saying that, yes, he believed in UFOs. He's had his own encounters and was convinced that they were intelligent beings from beyond the Earth.
That's awesome.
Now, I have one final question before we wrap up. Do you, in your opinion, do you think we'll ever get the full story?
Well, you know, I would hope we will. The unfortunate thing is, if we look at the pattern that's gone on so far, we haven't had the full story. You know, government agencies still withhold significant amounts of data from us. I'm sure of that. Now, I think if we get the full story, it'll be through one of three ways. Either it'll be outside of government's hands and there'll be like some huge sighting wave, you know, kind of like the opening stages of Independence Day, and, you know, then let's hope it's good news rather than bad news. But, you know, if there's a huge wave of sightings all across the world, that could not be hidden, you know, that there's nothing, the cover-up would collapse. The other way is if the government decides to come clean. Now, they haven't done so far. Whether they will is another matter. Or the other way is if something leaks out of the government by accident, you know, somebody declassifies something in error, or something, you know, random occurs that nobody thought of, and the secret comes tumbling out that way. So I think it's going to be something like that if it happens, and I hope it happens. And I think, you know, we can't rule it out, but equally we need to be cautious and look at what's gone in the past and realize that despite the digging, we're still to a great extent looking for answers, you know, and it's possible that could go on for a while.
Wow, you know, I have so many other questions, you know, and an hour comes and goes. So hopefully down the road, especially when your new book comes out, we can have you back on PIR Radio. We'd love to have you back on.
Well, I'll be happy to come back.
I think we just barely, you know, got to a lot of main topping points, but I'm sure, there's so many other more topics I'd like to discuss, and chat with you. So hopefully down the road we can have you back on. That'd be awesome.
All right, well, thanks, guys. I'll be happy to come back on.
Thanks so much, Nick. I did enjoy the show, and you were very informative to fill in some of the details throughout my life of my infamous study through TV.
Bill, you watch too much TV. But before we let you go, we always give the microphone, so if you could give out your website and real quick, and then also if you want to give any shout-outs to anyone out there, the microphone's all yours.
All right. Well, my website is nickredfern.com. People can contact me there, and I always try and respond, you know, as quickly as possible to emails. I don't like to keep people hanging on, and, you know, if anybody's got any interesting stories to tell me, you know, I always keep them in confidence. If people don't want them to go any further than me, you know, they never do. But, you know, I'm always happy to listen to stories because, you know, even keeping them, you know, to myself, it aids in the search for the answers, and I think, you know, that's what we're looking for, are the answers to the mystery, and the more people that come forward, you know, remember that you're also in good company, like the company of astronauts. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I encourage people to speak out.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure I'll let you know. The podcast will probably be up here in about 30 minutes, so I'll send you an email with the link to the podcast.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Definitely. But we really appreciate it, and I can't wait to go back and listen, so I'm excited about this show. This is going to be one of my favorite ones.
All right, well, thanks again for having me on, and anytime you want me back, just let me know.
Thanks so much, Nick.
I will do that. Thanks, Nick.
Bye.
Thanks, Nick. Have a great evening.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks a lot. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bill, we didn't even, you know, we just broke, you know, a little bit into the topic. You know, what would be interesting is to have Nick, you know, when we have Paul Shishi on as have Nick with us, too.
All right, yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing, and I thought about it as I was driving to work this morning, was to ask about the 2012 and see how all that laid in with the theories and if there was any, you know, what his thought was, but I had forgotten.
But I definitely want to have Nick back on. That's a guarantee. I mean, we just barely, I mean, like I said, I mean, we can talk, you know, Bigfoot. He's done Bigfoot and Chupacabra. I mean,
I love Bigfoot, actually. Do you know Bigfoot? You know why I love Bigfoot so much?
You know, we've never had a Bigfoot show on PIR Radio.
Should do it, because I saw Bigfoot. No, I'm just kidding. I saw a big black bear, but you know, there's supposed to be a Bigfoot in Pennsylvania, too, you know?
And in Ohio, the Ohio grass thingy, I call it, and down in Florida, the Okeechobee ogre.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the Florida skunk ape.
The skunk ape. So you're into it, Kurt. You're right there with it.
I do my research on TV.
TV research, too.
But you know what? We have a DVD to give away. One DVD to give away.
Kurt, if you want to give out the number and type it in the chat room, and to the first person that's able to call in, please don't block your number.
All right, the men in black need to stop interrupting us.
Oh, yeah, and the men in black, please beep, beep, beep on the number. And we'll give out the DVD. And, you know, I know our hate mail gal, Mandy, really wants it, so we have to work on that. But
I think I'm typing the correct number in the chat room, so if you get the wrong number, let me know. I think it's 678-459-2548, but I'm not sure if that's correct or not. So, do you know who we have next week?
Call. No, I don't. Oh, I looked at the webpage, too, and I meant to note that. Who do we have next week, Kurt?
Who do we have next week? We have Jeffrey Kimball. He was scheduled a while back, but he had to cancel, so we had him reschedule.
Awesome. And he's from Ghost Group, or?
He's from, like, Northern Paranormal, something like that.
Nice.
We have a caller on the line. Is this Bob James?
Bob James?
We have a James?
Why couldn't I call?
You can call, of course.
Andy? Oh, I didn't think I was allowed to call.
Was that the right number?
Huh?
Was that the right number I gave out, 678-459-2548?
Well, I hope so, because I'm talking to Kurt and Bill.
No, this is John and Biff.
John and Biff, okay. Well, as long as you have the PIR thing there, I'll be all set.
This is RIP radio.
Hey, guys, it was a great show tonight.
Yeah, I loved it.
It was fun. We haven't got an update from our hate mail gal. Do we get any hate mail?
Oh, guys, you know, I don't even know. I haven't even checked my own mail in about a week and a half. So I'll definitely get on that, and I'll let you know. He's whacking, as you say.
That's it. She's fired. She gets no DVD.
That's right. You know,
I am not fired. That's the first time I haven't checked my email.
Here's what we're going to do tonight. Mandy is not fired, but she doesn't get a copy of the DVD tonight.
No, that's not fair.
Let's fire her
and give her a copy of the DVD.
Here's what we're going to do for tonight only. For tonight only, since we have some live listeners, and I'll pay.
Is that like paying me to stay as far away as possible?
I'll pay for the postage. Is that the people that are in the chat room will each get a copy of the PIR Radio DVD?
It's like being on the Oprah Show.
Just email Bill at PIR Radio.
So if Aaron, Mandy, and Chicken Zombie Tom can email their addresses to bill@PIRradio.com, you've all won a copy of the PIR Radio first 100 episodes, 2 years DVD.
Awesome. Thank you so much, guys.
And Mandy, you didn't win. It was Louie that won.
Man, you know, we should withdraw that from Aaron, because that's post-air to Canadian A.
A? It's going, you know, maybe we'll, but you know what, it has the Canadian National Anthem on that show. That's, Aaron's show was the 100th episode, so she actually get to hear herself twice, because she was on back in June of 2010, I believe, or 2009.
Well, we'll have to foot that, because we did play the anthem,
yeah.
So postage will be paid.
I think you played the anthem about 3 times on that show.
Oh, Canada. Our home and native land.
Do I have to send my email address? Because I think you guys already have it.
Your mailing address. We need your mailing address.
Mailing address. Okay, yeah, I'll send that out to you.
We know where to find you. It's Mandy at PIR Radio, Hate Mail Gale.
Or it's Mandy at prime.org, primerib.org. I'm hungry.
That too. All right, guys. Well, it was a great show tonight, and I look forward to next week. Thank you so much.
Glad you made it back.
Welcome back, Mandy. We missed you.
Yeah, me too. Me too. You guys take care.
You also, too now.
Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Good night, Mandy.
Way back in 2009, Aaron says.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's right. So for tonight only, I mean, next week we will probably give away one copy.
It's okay, yeah.
But hopefully everyone likes that. Bill put that together. I sent him the DVD. I actually sent you the DVD.
Yeah, no, the mail was real slow. It took about 2 weeks to get here.
That's because I didn't send it out till Saturday.
Kurt realized, oh, this needs to get mailed.
Yes, Aaron, a copy will be put in the mail. I don't know. It's up to Bill when he puts it in the mail.
I didn't get any email yet. Email Bill at...
He doesn't have your address, Aaron. It's
we
Bill.
Need that, you know, the Canadian address, eh? Anyway, Kurt, what a great show.
It was fun. It was. I can't wait to go back and listen. I mean, it full of information, especially, you know, talking about the Bolivian UFO crash and, you know, we didn't talk really conspiracies, but we got a lot of information out of Nick, I believe.
I think the conspiracy is really that the fact that these are not things that are put forth from the governments, and, you know, except for Bolivia, they kind of didn't know back in 78, but that's the conspiracy is not about, well, yeah, about the aliens, but they do this with all information, so it is a big conspiracy. I believe that to be more true than not.
True. So don't forget Aaron, Mandy, and CZ, Chicken Zombie Tom. Email Bill, you'll get a copy of the PIR Radio DVD, 2-year compilation of 100 episodes. And it will also have the 95 artworks, too.
Yes.
Only 95 artworks.
That's okay. They don't care about the art.
Or actually 93 artworks or something like that.
No, 95.
95? Okay, 95.
I'm sorry, Kurt. I cut you out 5 pieces of art. But
it's okay, though. But you know what? If they take a look, though, the last 5 episodes, we'll have the artwork stamped onto the...
I know. I noticed that.
MP3. I figured out how to do that. You like that.
That's awesome. I did notice that. See, Kurt, and you're so efficient with the way you dated and named and labeled every folder.
I try to label everything, you know.
Very awesome. Very professional, Kurt. You're going to make history. And
I'm anal retentive.
You're dead and buried, and your great-grandchildren have this disc. They're going to know all these things, the date, the time, you know. The
you
art.
Betcha. And if Matt Monroe's listening, we'd love to... You know,
have
you
sponsors.
Yeah. Check out our sponsor page, Matt Monroe. Maybe Brad will work over the money or something. we're looking for sponsors, so if anyone out there wants to sponsor us, check out our sponsor page. We got some great deals out there.
Yeah, it's cheap to get an add on, so
yeah, it's not too expensive. You can actually also be a star on PIR Radio for one day. You know, we'll have you on for an hour if you get one of the super duper packages.
And if you really pay us a lot, we'll replace Mandy for you. You know? You could be the new Hate Mail sponsor.
That's right. The new Hate Mail sponsor is tampons. Kotex.
Okay, on that note, right, my shout-outs go to Lori, because these producers called us to make a little thing, and it's on Haunted Tube under my profile, but a little introduction, so it's kind of cheesy, and it was a long night, and I edited it and didn't show up for work the next day. But it's on hauntedtube.com, and it was just for this. My feeling was they're going to go to a haunted location in Philadelphia. They wanted 3 or 4 teams, and whoever provided the best evidence that they felt or something or voted on would move on to the next city. That was my feeling from the description that Lori met. Said they would battle against, against a new team in a new location. And I,
you know what, I have one word for that.
I think it was called Ghost Quest, but we did make a little demo video and an introduction video, as I called it. And you know what? We did not hear back from the producer at all, like a nay or yay. But it's still to happen in a couple weeks. But I really hate that. You know, we went through a lot of time and effort and energy. And you know what? If you're not even going to say we sucked, then to the hell with you.
I think they're in cahoots with Matt. Ooh, did I say that on live on air?
Oh, I just got two emails.
Damn, I got none.
So look out for that show. I think it's going to be called Ghost Quest, but the name, of course, might change. And just think, I could have been on it, but that's it.
Alrighty. I have shout-outs to my lovely daughter, Kennedy, who was one.
One?
On the 26th of February.
Man, she screwed up a couple episodes, you know, that girl.
Like five episodes.
She got in the way.
And then they moved to Chicago, too. You know, we would have actually like 115 or something like that.
That's all right. Now people know why there's breaks in the dates. That's good.
The move to... But we didn't have any breaks when Kennedy was born. We pre-recorded shows for that.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She didn't get in the way.
The move to Chicago got in the way. And the damn Comcast. Comcast sucks.
Yeah.
I have two words for Comcast.
They suck.
Fuck you, Comcast.
Oh, man. Now we're going to get some hate mail.
I'm trying to get it from, you know, Manny needs some email. All right, we got to get off here. All right.
And now, beep, beep, FBI. Ooh, boop. You're on the bed.
Now, do you have anything else before we get off here tonight?
That's it.
All righty, Bill.
Keep it paranormal.
And hopefully everyone will get their paranormal radio experience with Nick Redford on PIR Radio. We will see you next week, everyone.
Next week. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to PIR Radio. Come back every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the ASPRN Radio Network and the PRO Radio Network to get the very best in paranormal radio on the Internet. Please visit our website at www.pirradio.com. PIR Radio is sponsored by the Peach State Paranormal Radio Network and www.hauntedtube.com.